I Hate Politics is a podcast about a human activity we love to hate. I am Sunil Dasgupta. One of the features of the U.S. federal system is that states compete with and are compared to each other. In the Washington metropolitan area, Maryland and Virginia are a constant comparative pair. And for several years now, Virginia has been outpacing Maryland in economic growth. Why? The problem has vexed politicians and businesses. We've done episodes on government incentives to attract businesses and talk to businesses who say that it's harder to work in Maryland than it is to work in Virginia. Look right now at the debate in the Maryland legislature over making it easier to build data centers in the state. Virginia already has many. Brooke Learman, Maryland's comptroller, went further. She commissioned a study called the State of the Economy Report, which came out in January this year, 2024. And in this episode, she explains the findings. Why is it that the state of Maryland has really low unemployment, but also slow economic growth? What is the difference between unemployment rate and labor participation rate? How does housing cost matter? Stay with us. I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are dirty, messy, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it. Music for this episode comes from the Fugazi-inspired Washington, D.C. garage punk band Apollo 66. Travis Hodges on guitars and vocals, Alex Morse on bass and vocals, Sean Henderson on drums, and Chris Morse on the tambourine. You can find them at apollo66rock.com. Brooke Learman, welcome back to I Hate Politics.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
What is the central conclusion of the State of the Economy report that your office put out?
In a couple sentences, all, 100 plus pages, I'd say that the state of the economy of Maryland is strong, and we have a unique portfolio of companies and opportunities, but we face some challenges that we need to address. And if left unaddressed, will continue to hinder our economic growth and development.
What specific challenges are you seeing?
A lot of it comes down to workforce. Economic growth really began stagnating in around 2017, before the pandemic, when Maryland started falling behind our surrounding states in terms of economic growth. But it's interesting because the sluggish growth is actually concentrated in the private sector. So the private sector is really primed for growth, but we don't have enough people working to support that growth. We have a labor shortage in Maryland. Currently, we have roughly 3 job openings for every 1 job seeker. And our low unemployment rate really signals that tight job market. And so the question then, right, is why are we here? And then after that, what do we do about it? Diving into the report, we start looking at what are some of the reasons for this tight job market and for this lower labor force participation.
Can you distinguish between the labor participation rate and the unemployment rate? What is the difference? Why does it matter?
An unemployed person is someone who is not employed and actively looking for work. The labor participation rate measures the labor participation rate in Maryland fell 4 percentage points between 2020 and 2023. Pre-pandemic, our labor participation rate was 69.3%. That was January 2020. Our current labor participation rate as of quarter two in 2023, at least, was 65.2%. So the difference is about 181,000 people who are no longer employed or looking for work. So the decline in the labor participation rate also was most prominent among men and women between the ages of 25 and 44.
So what is your analysis for why?
So we pose a couple of hypotheses. First, we started looking at gender differences, because actually women have had an outsized departure from the labor force in Maryland. Women in the workforce faced steeper job losses and slower job recovery than men because they were heavily represented in sectors that saw those heavy job losses: healthcare, education, accommodations, food services. Maryland women aged 16 to 34 saw a 2% decline in labor participation from 2019 to 2021. And by comparison, though, only 1% of women ages 16 to 24 and 0.4% of women ages 25 to 34 dropped out of the labor force nationally. One of the reasons that they might stay out of the labor force is access to affordable quality childcare. There was a decline in childcare spots through COVID. Maryland is also one of the costliest states in the nation for childcare.
So the difficult part for me to understand this labor participation rate argument is also that despite this fall, Maryland has the highest median household income in the country. So on the one hand, the household income is high. On the other hand, you're saying that, you know, women in particular not participating in the labor force, you know, it could be voluntary.
Yeah, no, they don't need to. Oh, I don't think anywhere in the report we say, and I would certainly never say, that women are a monolith. And the reason that women are participating less is because of access to childcare. That is absolutely false. Some women have access, you know, are having childcare access problems. And that is a reason, I believe, that some women cannot re-enter the workforce. But I also know, and part of this is because we have the highest median income, that there are some women who probably during COVID said, wow, we can make it work on one income and I'm not going back. I have kids at home that I'm just going to take care of, or there are other things I want to do. There's also a third, you know, sort of possibility. And that is women as entrepreneurs themselves. So, you know, the data for this isn't available yet, but we do know that women have made big strides in becoming entrepreneurs and starting businesses themselves. You know, maybe it's that they turned what was a side gig into their full-time gig, and they're selling online now. Those women should count as participating in the labor force, but if they are not to the point yet, either where they're employing people or it just hasn't percolated up yet, we might not have that data.
So on balance, then, how worried should we be about this labor participation rate?
You know, one of the other factors that is affecting our labor participation rate and just the labor force generally is our population growth, right? Or lack thereof. So I think, you know, digging into that a little bit, Maryland is really mirroring a national trend that's taken off since the pandemic, where people are moving from high cost of living areas to low cost of living areas. And that is not what used to happen. You know, it used to be that growth, you moved from often lower cost of living areas to higher cost of living areas because that was where the jobs were, right? And that was where the economic activity was. But that is not what is happening now. And for the last 10 years, Maryland has really experienced Maryland residents moving to other states in greater numbers than those moving to Maryland. In fact, for the first time since World War II during COVID, we lost population, right? So people are moving to Maryland from states like New York and New Jersey because it costs less to live here. But then people are moving from Maryland to lower cost of living states like Florida or the Carolinas. We looked a little bit about at who is coming and who is leaving. So people leaving Maryland tend to be under age 26 or over age 55 and make either less than $50,000 or more than $100,000. People coming to Maryland tend to be between the ages of 26 and 44. Which is interesting because that's really the age group where you're likely, you know, in your early career, you're starting a family. So maybe you are attracted to our high wage job market, quality public schools, strong government services, you know, things like that. And so, that's really who's coming and going.
But that's where also you found the lowest labor participation rate, right? 26, 44?
Yes. I will say though, one of the most interesting things to me that we found, and we write about this in the report, is the number one factor that came up around affordability was housing. And it came up as the number one issue, I think, at every roundtable that we held. Employers concerned that they were trying to attract people to work with them, and there was no place for those people to live. That was at least in anywhere close to where their headquarters was or their jobs would be. So really, housing affordability is a big issue that's identified in the report.
But I went and checked housing costs in Virginia, mm-hmm. like county by county, right?
Yeah, it's expensive there too.
It is more actually in Northern Virginia versus suburban Maryland.
Yeah.
Right. Northern Virginia is more expensive, almost up to Richmond. Everything is more expensive in Virginia mm-hmm. than in suburban Maryland. But it seems Virginia is growing, but we are not. Why is Maryland unique that housing costs is such a drag, but it is not a drag in Virginia?
It's a good question. And I don't know that our report necessarily gets into that level of comparison with Virginia. Home prices, of course, have risen nationally since 2019. But in Maryland, they have risen much more quickly than they have nationally.
The median home price in Fairfax yep. County in Virginia is almost $700,000. Mm-hmm. The median home price in Montgomery County is, I believe, $577,000. Mm-hmm. There's a huge $100,000 difference there. You can compare Prince George's to Prince William. You can compare Howard to Loudoun. I mean, Loudoun, again, is the median home price there is $700,000. So I'm just curious why Virginia can continue to have high housing costs and continue to grow while Maryland has housing cost problems, clearly, mm-hmm. right? But can find a way to growth.
Sounds like a good topic for a next report to really delve into that. But, you know, I mean, it's a good question. I think there's certainly a number of items that cause people to move one place or another. But housing certainly came up in every conversation that we had around affordability.
If you do another report, I'd be very interested in finding learning about what you find. You know, you mentioned at the start sluggish revenue growth, right? And it is true that now revenue growth is, I mean, the budget is in deficit. But merely 2 years ago, the state was in windfall. What is our projection mechanism such that we go from this large windfall to deficit in 2 years? What is it about our projections that give us these kinds of variation?
I want to push back a little bit because that windfall was from the federal government, right? It was ARPA dollars. It was one-time dollars that we all knew were one-time dollars. So the reason that we had those huge surpluses had very little to do with the functioning of our economy and everything to do with the federal dollars coming into the state.
When I did interviews on this 2 years ago, there were two parts of it. There was federal dollars, but income tax was up. Sales taxes were up significantly.
So sales taxes were up during COVID. If you look at sales tax revenue prior to the pandemic, you will see that it was going down because people had started spending more money on services and less money on goods. And then during COVID, that flipped on its head because you couldn't spend any money on services because you couldn't do anything. So that is the answer about our sales tax revenue. And I think when you talk about structural deficits, right, you're talking about both revenues and expenditures. And the numbers used as part of the state budget, of course, come from the Department of Legislative Services and the Department of Budget and Management. Revenue calculations are also a part of the calculation or a part of that equation. Changes come from changes in revenue estimates, changes in budgeted expenditures, and the fiscal impact of the most recent legislative session, whatever it was. We have known for several years, you know, since, for instance, we passed the Blueprint for Maryland's Future, that we needed to find a revenue source to make sure that we could pay for it. That is not surprising to people. I think we've known this. The General Assembly knows it. We know it. On the revenue estimate side, there's the Board of Revenue Estimates, and they produce an economic forecast and revenue forecast three times a year, utilizing the information that we generate in the Office of the Comptroller, using information that they get from federal partners. It includes year-to-date revenue data. It includes projections from national economic consulting firms, econometric models. So, and Maryland is interesting. We're really a best practice state when it comes to revenue forecasting. The Bureau of Revenue Estimates presents forecasts to and reaches a consensus with a group called the Revenue Monitoring Committee, the RMC. And that committee is comprised of, it's a multi-agency committee, and it's got fiscal officers with many years of experience and different viewpoints, right? It's not just our agency. It's DBM, DLS. DBM is the Department of Budget and Management. The secretary there is appointed by the governor. And DLS is the Department of Legislative Services, whose leader is appointed by the General Assembly, right? So we have all different people with different viewpoints coming together to adopt and they have to work to reach consensus on what our revenue forecast will be. That is then presented to the Board of Revenue Estimates, and we vote on whether to approve that forecast or not. And of course, look, forecasting is difficult. It's not precise. Specifically with the state's economic forecast, there are certainly factors that can never be forecasted accurately with consistency. Particularly challenging is the personal income tax, right? Which includes—
Why?
Well, because it includes both business income and capital gains. And it is challenging to know what capital gains income is going to look like on a annual basis. I would say especially the past 5 years or 4 years, it has swung fairly wildly from lows to highs. And in FY22, one out of every $5 deposited in the state's general fund was from non-wage personal income, meaning capital gains. And so we just have a large percentage of our income that is generated by high income folks who are making it from non-wage income. And that's just not as steady, and it doesn't grow as steadily as, when you have the withholding income tax.
So can we use the Dow Jones to predict?
I mean, we have to look at it, right? It matters. It matters. Looking at the trends of the market really matters to how our state, what our state's income is going to be, what our state's revenue is going to be.
You said something very interesting, which is that the people that make up the various abbreviations that you use that make up the Bureau of Revenue Estimates that need to come to a consensus. That means there is no natural consensus. There's a natural agreement that they have to make an agreement. In personal finance, we can have a consensus number about income and expense or whatever it is, right?
Yep.
But in public finance, very hard to do.
No state, and certainly nor the federal government, can be sure with certainty, you know, with absolute 100% certainty, what our economy is going to do.
What is Maryland's level of confidence? What is the level of confidence that other states might have? What is practically possible?
I'm not sure that I can say what our, you know, give a new numerical estimate to our level of confidence in our data. In FY23, our estimate was within 0.2% of actual growth. Yeah. So, no, but I think, well, look, you know, I know economic head and tailwinds, they change based on current events, shocks to our local, state, regional, and national economy. I mean, you know, current example, high vacancy rates for commercial real estate in our city centers, the preference for remote work for some, rising housing prices in traditionally affordable parts of the country. Those are sort of aftershocks of the COVID-19 pandemic. And we're still trying to determine what that will mean over the long term for our revenue. And I would even argue that, you know, looking at how we need to also understand how we as Marylanders spend money to see if how we spend money now is the same as how we spent money 20 years ago when we established most of, you know, how we bring income into the state. So there's lots of things to look at.
So is there going to be a state of spending report now?
I mean, not a bad idea.
Okay. All right. I do want to talk about one spending category, sure. Childcare.
Oh, yep. Mm-hmm.
The blueprint in particular had a plan to bring universal pre-K to a lot of the state. And it has been difficult. In part because private providers have not wanted to join the state network. And therefore, there's a shortage.
Yep.
There is I think last year the state paid $13,000 or $14,000. This year they're going to pay a little bit more.
Yep.
But, you know, Maryland providers get paid $20,000 and $25,000. That's a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
Moreover, they have to take on the added expense of training up their people and then paying them the same wage as their local education agency.
Yep.
You know, so this is a huge burden.
It is.
And there doesn't seem to be a pathway forward, especially given that we are now in a budget deficit.
Yep. Yeah. What are we going to do?
How are we going to get more women in the labor force if we can't get that blueprint, pre-K system working?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, and I know that the folks at the AIB as well as MSDE are, you know, they have their work cut out for them. As you said, we need private providers to be partnering with our LEAs, our local education associations, and our, you know, local school boards to really work on this issue. But I think it's going to take a wholesale sort of reimagining of the childcare system. It's a really challenging model from a private perspective. And so it really does cry out, I think, for more state involvement and more public involvement in figuring out how to make the numbers work.
Well, so, you know, you said it's MSD problem, it's the accountability board issue, but really it's a revenue issue in the end, right?
Yes, it's a revenue issue, but it's more than that. It's also an organizational issue. How do we organize so that it's an easier regulatory process to make sure that private care providers are interested in working with their local school boards, right, to do this work? What makes it worthwhile for them to do that? There are a number of private companies who, you know, could be involved in government work, but they just choose not to because they think for whatever reason, oh, red tape, you know, headaches, blah, blah, blah. I'm not saying that's true or not. But if there's that perception or that reality, we need to figure out how to make it better and work better for the private companies so that we can do this work.
Brooke Learman, thank you for taking the time. Please come back.
My pleasure. Great to see you. Keep in touch.
You're listening to I Hate Politics. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. I'll be back with the wrap-up and lessons from my conversation with Maryland Comptroller Brooke Learman. What lessons should we draw from my conversation with Maryland Comptroller Brooke Learman? As a state, Maryland's economic growth has slowed, not just due to the pandemic, but going back to 2017. What is remarkable about Maryland's current condition is that the state has three openings for every person available to work. The private sector is particularly short of employees, but the state is losing instead of gaining population. The State of the Economy report identifies two primary reasons. First, a low labor participation rate, and second, high housing costs. The labor participation rate and the unemployment rate are different things, as Comptroller Learman explains. Whether a low participation rate is a good or bad thing depends on why it is happening. It isn't absolutely clear from the State of the Economy report. But for those Maryland families well off enough to be able to live on one income, a low labor participation rate is a voluntary choice for leisure, parenting, taking care of elders. It is less welcome when forced, such as due to high childcare costs. But even that calculation is not entirely one-sided. If childcare costs are indeed so high that it is better for one person to stay at home, it may mean that Maryland has high wage costs and the market is simply allocating labor to the most efficient uses. But if the cost of childcare is high due to regulatory cost, not wages, then that's producing inefficiency by keeping people out of work. This is most certainly a problem for low-income families. The Blueprint for Maryland's Future promised universal pre-K for low-income families and has not delivered, in part because of the state's high cost of childcare. Now, with the state in deficit, dramatic reimagination of childcare is, well, hard to imagine. Let's consider housing costs and economic performance. The State of the Economy report posits a negative relationship. High housing costs means slower economic growth. But the comparative data is noteworthy. The Commonwealth of Virginia, which is part of the same regional economy as Maryland, also has high housing costs. In fact, more than Maryland's, but nevertheless continues to grow at a clip even prior to the pandemic. Clearly, there is something more going on, and the 2024 version of the State of the Economy report does not have a clear answer. Comptroller Learman has said that she will look into it for the future. If you have thoughts of how to bring Maryland out of its era of slow growth, talk back to us. Record yourself on the phone and email us the file at producer@ihppod.org. You can use the same email if you want to share your music on the show. We welcome all genres. That's all for this episode of I Hate Politics, where we aim to stem the decline in local news by working with community voices. Don't forget to tune in to our Tuesday morning news analysis. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, and assistant producers Daniel Galeo, Katarina Gasek, and Catherine Amaya Escobar, with support from University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from the Fugazi-inspired Washington, D.C. garage punk band Apollo 66. Travis Hodges on guitars and vocals, Alex Morse on bass and vocals, Sean Henderson on drums, and Chris Morse on the tambourine. You can find them at apollo66rock.com. I hope you will subscribe and share the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and to your home. See you next time.